Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, celebrate the launch of The Night Soil Men, a gripping historical and political fiction by Bradford author Bill Brodie. Spanning four decades, The Night Soil Men explores the origins and evolution of the Independent Labour Party, the working class political movement founded in Bradford in 1893. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, delve into Brodie's captivating narrative and a tale of ambition, loyalty and betrayal.
Hello, hello. We're here to talk about Bill Brodie's new book, The Night Soil Men, which is a fictionalised account of the events leading up to the formation of the Labour Party in Bradford in 1893. Now, it's an extremely timely book, Bill, and it's come out at a perfect time, and I'm presuming you did put a bet on the date of the general election.
Sadly not. I'm not that well connected, I'm afraid.
We're going to leave lots of time at the end for questions and comments, so please do think of those, and we'll have a microphone roving around to help you shout out your questions. Right at the end, after the event, Bill will be signing copies of the book over in the bookie bit over there, and we're going to have a chat about the writing of the book and what led up to it and his processes. But first, Bill's going to give you a reading of from the beginning of the book, I think. Is that right, Bill?
Yeah, I saw right at the beginning.
So we can get a flavour of what this story and how Bill tells it is all about. So take it away, Bill.
Thank you. I was delighted when I realised that this gig, which is the first reading I've done for this, my new book, which was published about a week ago, that the first reading for the book is set in exactly the same place that the book itself begins. The book, as Lizzie, who organizes the festival, said, it was meant to be, she's saying. So, but, you know, coincidences always attend these sort of things, and it is very, very remarkable. But anyway, if you could shut your eyes and try and take yourself back to 1893 and imagine it's a horrible January morning with snow and wind, and two figures appear wending their way across the square. And they, of course, are on their way to attend the opening conference of what led to the formation of the Independent Labour Party on Peckover Street. Beginning of the book follows them through, this opening section I'm going to read you, follows them through and their process through Bradford. There are various digressions where you learn little about them. This is a shortened version. I've cut about half out. This is a sort of reading version, which is a little bit more dramatic, but representative of it. So it is 1893. This opening chapter is called Conference. As they crossed the square, the town hall clock was striking nine. Once more, the sun had neglected to rise over Bradford. Two smears of light that did relieve the gloom were in quite the wrong quarters of the sky. Whenever it snowed, Jim Sharp was reminded that the stone of the civic buildings was not black, but mossy green. However lightly he stepped, the scraping of his clogs through the slush almost drowned out the words of his companion. Jim swung round. They were still not being followed. This was the morning of the inaugural meeting of the Independent Labour Party. The world was about to be turned upside down, but nobody seemed in the least concerned. Outside the law courts, two policemen, lighting each other's clay pipes, did not give him a second glance. Under one arm, he was carrying a large bale of soft-leaded pencils. It could have been dynamite, for all they knew. He leaned his shoulder against one of the Doric columns, but it would not budge. He was no Samson. The tubby peelers could smoke on in peace. "There's smallpox passing through the ward again," Fred was saying. "Three streets a day, one house in four, like the plagues of old Egypt. The council says there's nothing it can do, but all the necessary powers are there in the Housing of the Working Classes Act. The Liberals just put things on the statute book, then joined the Tories in ignoring them. Fred Jowett's voice was slightly slurred, as if he was a toper, but Jim had never seen him go beyond a single half of dark mild. His mother came from Devonshire, but although he had often sat in the Jowett's parlour, Jim had never heard her utter a single word. Smallpox in January. It's a privy middens. The colder it gets, the worse the smell. Even after a frost, the air is full of flies. The ash freezes solid so it can't absorb, and then the dirt piles up until streams of urine carry it down the yards right up to your back doorstep. Once Fred got on to sanitation, there was no stopping him. How often Jim had wished that he would find a more elevated hobby horse to ride. When Fred was excited, his thick black hair ridged up like the hackles of an angry dog. Although the down on his upper lip gave him an adolescent look, he was already silvering at the temples. He didn't fuss about his appearance, but still contrived to have an almost dandified air. He wore a baggy grey suit with a red ribbon tie that was always on the point of coming undone. Jim could actually see the thoughts and emotions passing across those pale features. It was like prising open a fob watch to reveal the cogs and wheels whirring around inside. Even so, Jim had never glimpsed the least trace of meanness, fear, or calculation. He wasn't sure whether to envy Fred or to pity him. Perhaps a man without weaknesses was not really a proper man at all. And all he ever says, "Why can't you turn your thoughts to higher things?" Fred continued. "It's true what Kipling said about William Morris, that one decent primer on sanitary engineering is worth all the tomes of sacred smut ever written." Jim took his cue. "Oh, but I thought Kipling was a jingle, while Morris is on our side." "Yes," said Fred triumphantly, "but even good socialists can act like ninnies. And even a jingo is sometimes right." Jim decided not to inquire where he could obtain some of this sacred smut in order to reach a properly informed judgment. Before they had set out together, he had wagered Fred that in crossing the city they would not see on a single face anything approaching a smile. First they had encountered, trudging from somewhere to somewhere else, half a dozen swaddled figures who appeared to have no mouths at all. Then there had been a skeletal woman driving before her a pack of feral children. These had teeth aplenty, but no lips to speak of. Everyone was blighted. Even the peelers had seemed to be disgusted by the taste of their own tobacco. Now, beneath the statue of Forster, the great educator, a brindle terrier was busily worrying an obviously long-dead rat. On seeing them, it dropped its trophy and danced a little jig, revealing that it was missing a foreleg, then put its ears back, opened its jaws, and rolled out its scarlet tongue. "Nay, Fred," said Jim before his companion could speak, "dogs don't count." At the bottom of Chapel Street, the gates of the mills burst open, and they were engulfed by a great flood of humanity. The night workers had reached the end of their shift. Perhaps it was only to be expected that as the two men approached their appointment with history, they should find that everyone else was heading in the opposite direction. The first wave had separated them. Jim watched Fred forging up the hill as he himself was jostled sideways. His friend's mouth was still moving, even though he was no longer at his side. Jim was bigger and stronger, but stiffer and slower and bandy-legged, the result of childhood rickets. In the event of his meeting a pig in a passageway, perfect strangers were always telling him, it was unlikely that he would be able to stop it. Even when he was not carrying 200 pencils, he would walk for the sake of symmetry, with his elbows pointing outwards. Crowds terrified him. He felt swallowed, like Jonah in the belly of a whale. There had been rumours of kidnappers who, taking advantage of the press, would roll their victims up in carpets. Surely even the clay pipe policeman would notice gangs of roughs lugging wriggling lengths of Axminster. He saw that Fred had stopped and was peering through his chipped eyeglasses. Everyone found this myopia endearing rather than comical. It was as if he could never get your face into focus. It made Jim feel somehow blurred, not quite there. Although Fred was always talking about the people, Jim wondered if he had ever been able to see them properly. Perhaps a stronger pair of spectacles might modify his socialism. The faces in the crowd were sullen or downright hostile. They walked in silence, save for a curious hissing, as they drew on cigarettes or pipes, like a fuse burning down to a final explosion. It would just be Jim's luck to be in the middle of them when it finally happened. Even though they were working men like themselves, he still could not think of them as brothers. More people were emerging from the side streets. There were lost children seeking their parents, ragged pickpockets pulling off their mittens, evangelicals brandishing cheap tracts. But most were lonely souls in search of companionship. There were no carpet row kidnappers, but Jim could see looming ahead a couple of unusually tall mill girls, also arm in arm, like a distaff mirror image. The tiny heads bobbed on their goose-like necks while the hips swung sideways and forwards at the same time. The younger one's features were heavily pitted, but smallpox scars could be an adornment to some faces. She looked to have been hewn out of sandstone. Jim imagined his stubble striking sparks against those cheeks. Her companion resembled a ship's wooden figurehead, salt-stained and faded. Their chins were tilted, as if they got a clearer view down their nostrils, and their shawls were full pulled back to display expanses of bluish throat and chest. Jim already knew that there would be no pairing off. They were only interested in Fred. Women liked thick hair that they could get their fingers into, and they seemed to prefer little men, perhaps because they were more agile, less of a weight, or, if it came to beating, less likely to do a girl serious damage. Fred was trying to focus, but the glasses had slid to the end of his nose. It was apparent that to him, the women were nothing more than a pale obstruction. "Excuse us, gentlemen," he muttered, as stretching out a hand, he parted them like saloon doors. Jim caught a sweet, cider-like smell as they passed. "Nay, nay," he was protesting. "The lasses, Fred, ladies." But it was too late. Looking back, he could still see the women's faces bobbing above the crowd like backstroke swimmers on a choppy lake. They did not seem to have taken offence, however. From those black and yellow flashes, he could swear that they were actually smiling. He wasn't going to tell Fred, though. A bet was a bet. Now the masses convulsed again, clearing a path for a group of tall, hatted figures. Half a dozen under-managers were marching two steps behind their manager, who in his turn remained four steps behind the mill owner, Berens. You could have divined their relative status by the silkiness of their hats and the length of their watch chains. It appeared that God had given Gustav Berens the right to move in a six-foot radius of empty space, like the prime grave plot next to his father that awaited him in Undercliff Cemetery. In the 3 years since Sir Jacob's death, blithe young Gustav had somehow aged three decades to become the spitting image of his evil papa. At least he had the courage to show his face. Soapy Sam Lister had not been seen in public since his glorious victory over the Manningham Mill strikers. With their unblinking eyes and bloodless lips, their hands gripping the coat lapels and their shiny toe caps pointing at 10 to 2, the men reminded Jim of bad actors, or perhaps actors who, all too well cast, had descended into caricature. Since he became a socialist, he saw them in a new way, with contempt and even a little pity. "Poor devils," Fred had once commented. as a millocratic clan had rattled past in the grey, black and silver coach drawn by Shorts and Damages, those famous high-stepping geldings. It must be an awful strain having to be wicked all the time. They had recognised Fred. Jim saw the familiar consternation as they wondered why anyone would choose to be on what was obviously always going to be the losing side. It was common knowledge that Jowett had recently turned down the offer of a partnership with Leech's Mill. Could there possibly be something that he knew and they didn't? And if the Tories and if the Liberals and Tories won't agree to realistic taxation or fair rents, Fred looked up, vaguely aware of another obstacle to their progress, we shall be compelled to take the land, with or without compensation, into public ownership. Once again, his left hand, fingers spread wide, was extended in that hesitant yet peremptory gesture. Excuse us, ladies. The undermanagers became all tangled up with each other, skiffling their manager and forcing Barons to plant one immaculate foot in the filthy, swint-clogged gutter. As Jim and Fred passed through, that shockingly wizened face, almost swallowed up by an astrakhan collar, turned even whiter than before. Jim was certain that Fred was unaware of what had happened. Some cynics claimed that this was all an act, intended to raise Jowett's asking price beyond the regulation 30 pieces of silver, when he finally, inevitably, allowed himself to be suborned. But Jim knew that if he told Fred, he would go back and apologise to the man. He would rather have died than insult anyone. Such squeamishness would not do when the day of retribution dawned, unless a way could be found to cut Baron's throat without hurting his feelings. During the 5 years that he had worked with Fred, life had gradually come into focus. Fred made everything seem just as it should be, logical and inevitable, instead of a pointless bloody mess. Even an apparent disaster like the failed 1891 strike was merely a necessary pause for retrenchment before the steady march of socialism was resumed. Jim recalled how his friend's lunch had always come wrapped in the pages of the Sunday Chronicle, so that instead of eating, he would end up reading aloud the articles of that notorious radical Robert Blatchford. Fred had never seemed to notice when the ever-hungry apprentices filched his bread and scrape. At the mill, Jowett had risen from warp slayer to whitening liquor, and then, at the unprecedented age of 19, to overlooker. Everyone had suspected a cruel joke. Fred certainly had the delicate fingers for loom work, but how on earth could he carry the warps up and down the steep staircases between sheds? He was a mere 7 stone, while each beam weighed at least twice that. But Fred had been practicing for years, building up his arms and upper body in readiness for that moment. Although the tiny form disappeared beneath its burden, the beams then proceeded, seemingly of their own volition, to fly dizzyingly around the building. It was not Fred's outspokenness or election to the council that disturbed his enemies. It was a memory of those beams. A recent public meeting had been addressed by the sitting Liberal MP for Bradford West, Briggs Priestley, who had just talked out another feebly reformist factory bill. Fred had risen and silently pointed at the wretched man, who, as if a war plume had been launched unerringly towards his head, had flinched so violently that he fell off his chair. Jim had begun to wonder whether such power was only incidentally to do with socialism. At last, they reached the brow of the hill and turned into Peckover Street. Here the silent men before them kept pausing to spit or stamp the snow off their boots, while surreptitiously checking the pavement behind. Unlike Fred, they appreciated the need for discretion. Under the pull-down cloth caps were faces different from the night workers, displaying the even deeper tiredness of hard toil, overlaid by equally hard strivings against it. One by one, After a final scan of the street, they ducked inside the Labour Institute, except for the familiar figure of Horner, the Keithley delegate, who, drunk even at this hour, was throwing up against the tannery wall. Keithley was a peculiar place. Even its temperance fanatics were alcoholics. True to this day. Despite its dilapidated facade, the Institute was a relatively recent building. Originally a Wesleyan chapel, it had then become a Salvation Army barracks before being leased to the party at an extortionate rate, presumably making the point that although God could be bought, he did not come cheap. Jim saw that the two Sugdens from Laisterdyke were manning the door. Although identically squat, dark and unsmiling, they were not, in fact, related. "Comrades, Mr. Sharp here is supernumerary," announced Fred. "He'll be attending to refreshments and clerical needs and restoring order, should it need to be restored." Jim thrust out his chest and tried to look fierce, even though this reputation of his had been lightly come by. Although he had indeed recently ejected two lackeys of the Duke of Devonshire for disrupting a branch meeting at the Royal Oak in Shipley, these men had been, even for gamekeepers, thoroughly soused. The doorman's attention, however, was focused on a tall, red-bearded Irishman in an obscenely tight, russet-brown suit of scratchy-looking wool. Whatever could this strange paddy have to do with socialism? Jim wondered. Universal brotherhood was all very well, but a line had to be drawn somewhere. "There's only one delegate from Fabian Society on this list," Sugden One was saying, "and that's a Mr. Damatos."
"That's me," said the Irishman.
"I thought you said your name was Shaw," said Sugden Two.
"No," crowed Damatos Shaw. "I said my name was Damatos, to be sure."
The Sugdens pointed to their list. "This mark shows that Mr. Damatos has already arrived."
"And that black line below is where my name's been crossed out," said Shaw. "Everyone knows me. I've been up here for 3 days and I've spoken at 8 meetings already."
"Aye," sighed Sugden Two. "We walked out on you at Laycox last night. Permeation, permeation, permeation. We thought you were never going to stop."
"But I've come all the way from London."
Shaw somehow contrived to bestow 4 syllables on the capital. "If coming from London had out to do with it," said Sugden One, "then Dan Leno, Jack the Ripper, and the Bloody Queen will be writ down here and all." And so it was that on this very last step, Jim lost his bet. Shaw's smile was dazzling, like someone throwing open a canteen of cutlery. Wherever had the fellow got hold of such teeth? I'll stop at that point.
Thank you.
I'll give you a moment to get your breath back and a drink of water there. It's obvious, and in case anyone was wondering otherwise, this is not an academic history of the Labour Party, is it? It's a novel. First off, can you explain yourself? Can you talk about the title?
Yeah, we were discussing this before the event, and I was saying that nobody as yet has commented on the title of the book, which I thought a lot of people would have a real problem with. And then I realised that they weren't commenting on the title of the book because they did have a problem with it. And that's because the Knights or Men, of course, I'm sure most of you, many of you would know, they were the people who in apparently they were still going until, you know, around the time of the Second World War in some parts of the country, but they were the people who were hired to work by night, and they would go and empty the privy middens outside the terraced houses in working class areas, in this particular case in Bradford. And I mean, it was a job that had, how can I put it, brought with it not a great deal of social prestige. They were usually outcasts, were the Knights or Men. People would move away when they saw them. They would drink in their own pubs. They almost had their own sort of sodality. They were not really integrated into the community because if you ever saw them, they would be, especially in winter, to guard against disease and filth, they would be wrapped. So they'd be like wrapped figures, like something out of a monster movie, like the Mummy or the Frankenstein's monster. You know, you just see a pair of eyes coming through the wrapping. So they're generally the figure was sort of thin, of course, because you'd hear them in the night, the scraping noise, almost a figure of almost supernatural terror. And the reason I chose it for the title of the book, and indeed real knights or men do appear later in the book, and they become subject to much contention and discussion among later characters. They're quite an issue in it. But the thing is, it struck me was a perfect metaphor for politicians. And they do a dirty, difficult, but very necessary job and don't get a lot of thanks for it. To some extent are, especially working class politicians of that particular time, but are almost sort of outcasts because of what they do. So what they do is a vitally important public service, but everybody crosses the road when they're coming towards them. So is that sense of outsiderdom, as I say, this is much examined later on. There's a long sequence on the relations between knights or men and politicians. But I think people feel a little bit queasy about, I remember talking to an old editor of mine when I first had the idea of the book, and he sort of said, well, you can't call it that because, you can't have a book that announces itself as being all about excrement. But I thought I'd take the chance and just see if I sell any copies. Then we'll know who's right, won't we? But I think it's a good title for it, and I love it. It's just a funny thing that, it came to me almost immediately. I thought, what am I going to call it? And I thought, is there anything I can call it? And then afterwards, I began to realize why I called it that. And I think an awful lot of it, I'm sure David would find the same thing, but an awful lot of it with writers is you do something on instinct and think, why on earth did I do that? And then afterwards, you begin to figure out that, there were real deep reasons for it. And as you keep writing it, you realize you needed to do that for the subsequent writing. So a lot of it is that sort of trust thing. But I'm quite happy to call it Knights or Men, and, as everybody seems determined to ignore it, I'll let them ignore it, as a title. But I'm glad you brought it up. I'm glad you had the courage to bring it up.
Yes, ask the difficult questions. Here's another one. What themes did you really want to talk about in this story, and why did this story lend itself to what you wanted to talk about human nature and about people?
Well, I got very interested in the material through a friend of mine who's some local historians who may be in the audience would know. It's a guy called Paul Jennings, who I was at school with, and he's a big expert on the Bradford alehouse, indeed the English alehouse in general. And I've been going around Bradford with him on important research and field trips to the pubs of Bradford, which, we didn't want to do, we had to do, And so we'd wander around and do that. But, he knew all the areas, and he would always be a fund of lore about, who'd live where, what they'd done, why the street was named that, and all this sort of stuff. It's fascinating. And I got very interested in, he was talking quite a lot about Fred Jowett, who you just met in the introduction there, in the opening section. And he was a long-term Bradford MP, initially for the Labour Party, and then latterly for the Labour Party, and left a tremendous legacy in terms of the welfare work that he did. Free school meals in Bradford are pretty much down to Fred, other people too. There's the lot of social housing was built in Bradford through his good offices. Free school meals in Bradford came really as a result of that. And I became very, very interested by Fred Jowett. And Paul gave me this book on Fred Jowett and Phil Snowden, who is another character in the book who appears later on in this section. The three main characters in the book all appear in this opening section, and then the next couple of sections, they all come together, and then they all move in and out of each other for the rest of the narrative. And I just became really, really fascinated by the whole thing. It just really began to sort of live for me. But also, it was relevant to me, because, and I think my friend Paul felt this at the same time, because we were just hitting middle age, and we were rather kind of, we felt ourselves to be, to some degree, disillusioned and disappointed men. I mean, the social changes, the lives that we dreamed of living or thought we'd live, because we'd have all been at school together and we'd all have these very highfalutin dreams about the exciting new world we'd be living in. We'd hit disillusion and, a lot of friends of mine were having bad times. Friends of mine died around that time. It was a very, very difficult period, really. Hitting the 40s is a difficult time. And I wanted to write a book, I suppose. I was just thinking of writing a book around my experiences, because most of my work is sort of semi-autobiographical. This book, of course, isn't. And I was looking, I became very interested in this other material, and I thought, well, this is very germane, reading what happens to these people in the forward march of socialism. I think, yeah, they go through the same things that we've gone through, it's the same thing. And then I thought, well, how can I apply this to my own situation, or our situation, telling our story? I thought, no, they're more interesting than I am. they're more interesting than me and my friends are. This is really fantastically fascinating material that nobody really knows very much about. And of course, there are some good academic studies, but they, because they're academic studies, you can like get a faint whiff of it, but the stuff doesn't really live. You don't feel it at your nerve ends. You don't feel what it would be like to be there and living that life and knowing these people, you know, being intimate with them, being part of their lives. And I mean, I really find, in a curious sort of way, these three main characters, or I should just slightly to digress, three main characters are Fred Jowett, who you've met, Philip Snowden, who he meets in later on in the second chapter, and a third person who is not local. This guy is a Scouser, and he's called Victor Grayson. And he is largely forgotten now, although there are biographies. But he's generally, when he is remembered, he's always known as the great lost leader of the Labour Party. And his story is unutterably fascinating, and you couldn't make it up. All I can say is he's the most fascinating character, a force of nature, absolute enigma, endlessly fascinating. I wanted to try and get inside somebody who is sometimes a devil, sometimes an angel, sometimes all too human. And I wanted to write his story as well as on top of the local stuff. So the material took me over. And from just simply writing a book that would be a sort of just me and my mates falling over and complaining about stuff, this was a more important story and I started writing it. That's how I got into doing it, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. You talk about Grace and who is perhaps not as well known as the others. And he was able to become like almost an avatar for you to explore the world in a way. So
yeah, well, I mean, I love all the other characters. So, I mean, he doesn't take the whole book over. And in fact, oddly enough, I think what really happens in the book is a very, very strange thing. The three characters very, very gradually all merge into one. So in a funny way, at the end of the book, it ends with a funeral. It ends up with Philip Snowden's funeral. Well, a ceremony to mark Philip Snowden's funeral up on Akenshaw Moor. Just up above Keighley. And at the end of that, there's a very strange sequence, which I can't really describe to you, but the sequence when effectively Fred Jowett, who's the only one of the three to survive, suddenly, even though he had a lot of differences, and in fact, he quite hated Grayson for much of the time, but at the end of it, he realizes that he's carrying them inside himself. And that in a sort of strange way, these three totally dissimilar people, one an idealist, the other, that's the Jowett character, obviously, who you've met. Snowden, who is an incredibly ruthless intellect, very intelligent, very, very cruel man in lots of ways. And Grayson, who is just, you know, how can one describe him, really? A libertine, champagne socialist, lover of men and women, brilliant mob orator. Disappeared in the most mysterious circumstances, even today. Nobody really knows how he just vanished off the face of the earth one morning. You know, absolutely fascinating stuff. But at the end of it, Fred, who seems to be the most boring of them, you realize he's taken it all on board and he's carrying it with him. And so all the limitations that Jim Sharp sees at the beginning of the narrative, he's lost by the end of the narrative. And he goes on into the future, and he is the future of socialism. And that, I suppose, is the thrust of the book. I didn't even realize that sort of shape in it until relatively recently when I was just sort of talking to a friend of mine about it, and he made me realize the shape of it. And again, it's another one of those things where, you know, the more you meet people and talk about it and read it to them, and they read and they give you your feedback, you know, they begin to find things that are there. And you sort of know they're there, but you don't quite realize why they work in the way that they do. And it's a funny sort of feeling. I just feel it's a book I was born to write. And in fact, oddly enough, when I was a kid, when I was about 17 or 18, somebody said to me, "You think you're going to be a writer, what kind of books are you going to write?" And I said, "I want to write Fame is a Spur," which is a famous Howard Spring book about socialism, which in some ways slightly resembles this, but rewritten by the terrifying French modernist Louis Ferdinand Céline, who is this total avant-garde writer and, you know, incredibly sort of transgressive writer. And I somebody said, "What did you mean by that?" I said, "I don't know, I just said it, you know, because it sounded smart." But damn me, 40 years later, I ended up writing that book. And I had no idea I was going to do it. You know, but the material came along, and I just happened to be in the way of it, and it just sort of ran me over. And it has to be written, so I wrote it. But enough of me.
I think we should see if I'm getting a question. I just wanted to point out, obviously, it all happened a long time ago. You've got historical records, you've got biographies, but you've obviously had to make these characters three-dimensional in fictional terms. I did like the fact the Daily Mail reviewed the book, and I don't know if it seemed like almost begrudging for them to say how good it was, but they did mention that you use sex lives to make the characters live on the page, which I thought was quite funny.
I think actually Victor Grayson's the only one who really has what you call an interesting sex life. The others are pretty straight ahead, really.
Yeah.
I was amazed by the Daily Mail. Yeah, but strangely enough, they did like it. I've never been reviewed by the Daily Mail before. And its first review was the Daily Mail, so you know. But I think now everybody will say the Daily Mail likes it. We're not going to touch it.
Does anyone have any questions they would like to ask Bill about the book? Gentlemen at the front, thank you.
I'm always confused by the ILP and the Labour Party.
Yeah.
But also, I always thought that it was founded like during the Manningham Mill strike rather than after. And that last thing is, was it actually founded in the Peckover, on Peckover Street, corner of Church Bank?
Yeah. That's where they had the inaugural meeting. Oh, I should, by the way, mention, I'm sure most people sort of gathered it, but my Irish accent's so terrible. George Bernard Shaw's at that meeting, and of course it's Shaw who's trying to get into the meeting, and they won't let him in the meeting. So that, just in case my accent didn't convey it. I really like George Bernard Shaw, and I wanted to bring him in. He does reappear in the novel occasionally as well, because he's quite an important minor character. Now, it was interesting. I mean, obviously, talk of founding a party. And, I mean, part of what happens in, because there's a long description that follows what you just heard, which is the meeting itself. And so they're all trying to decide on a name, and they're all arguing about it and stuff like that. I mean, certainly it was being bruited abroad with the Manningham Mill strike that it was about time to form a party. And this meeting was called to, you know, thrash it out. All the various factions were there. So you had Heinemann's, the Social Democratic Foundation. You had Keir Hardie, and they said Keir Starmer. Keir Hardie, the better Keir. Keir Hardie was there, you know. And so that was it. But it came, I mean, the early history of the Labour Party is quite confused, because, of course, a lot of people, until relatively recently, I think, used to date the beginning of the Labour Party from the founding of the Labour Representation Committee in 1900, which is a sort of later thing. But no, I think you can say, I mean, it was coming for a long time, and it had almost, by the time the meeting took place, it had almost formed itself, but didn't really have an agreed name. But they came out of that with a program, a prospectus, with an identity forged. I mean, it was a long and fractious meeting. I mean, it's quite a funny read. And of course, when you read the accounts, it's just gold dust, the material. I mean, it's so brilliantly funny and interesting and witty. But quite interesting, I was talking to David earlier about sources. And I had a little rule with my sources, which was that I read everything I could find, which is a great deal, because I researched it for the best part of 10 years, over 10 years, and I had the idea around for longer. But the thing was, I made it so absolutely scrupulously, I followed the history, but where I had free play, where people didn't know what happened, where there's no record of it, where there isn't a record, I then allow my imagination to take over. And of course, I've convinced myself that, in fact, I know by some secret knowledge what happened in all the gaps that I filled in. But, you know, that's sort of the way of it. But I think we can probably say that Bradford and Peckover Street own the Independent Labour Party. I should say, there used to be a plaque up there and it's gone, which is so sad. Yeah, sorry? Yeah, I know. It's really sad. It's really sad. It's a real pity, because I wanted a picture of, because of course the hall is still there, although it's got a shop front there now, the old congregational hall that they'd hired from the Baptists or whoever it was. But the thing is, you know, I was out there with a photographer friend of mine who's in the audience. And we're trying to get a shot of the front of it, but you just can't get a shot of the front of it because of the new frontage they put up, and because the street is so tight. But no, it's Bradford's very own. I think we should be very proud of it. I should also say that there isn't a plaque on Fred Jowett's home either. That's something that I think I'm going to really try and do something about, because he should really have a plaque up. And I know there's a lot of people in the local history community in Bradford who really think very, very highly of Fred Jow. And I think for the City of Culture year next year, I think that's something that we're going to try and do something about, because it would be nice to have Fred honoured as being, you know, one of the most important people in Bradford's history, but largely forgotten.
I think we'll take one more question at the front there.
Thanks very much. I came because, first of all, I was attracted about the Independent Labour Party because my grandfather, Peter Ross Miller, was a founder member of the branch in Lanarkshire.
Oh, yeah.
I was an electrician down the mine there. But also because of the Night Soil Men, because my first house had an outside privy, and I just thought I'd be quite interested to know a little bit more about. I know you talked about about them being perhaps an analogy for politicians. But the other thing, that the serious question really is, I don't know whether in your researches you knew anything or you can say anything about how the Independent Labour Party concept came to be spread to other parts of the country, that's all, and particularly up to Scotland.
Yeah, well, obviously Keir Hardie was at the meeting. It's an interesting thing because the book tends to work in jumps. So each section jumps like about maybe 4 or 5 years, but the narrative fills in the gaps in between. So I'd say probably if you were to go through it and almost like with a scissor and pacing, you could almost like create sequentially the spread of the ILP and the movement of it and how it went and where it went and who was involved in it. But as it's spaced out throughout the narrative, you read the whole book, it would probably come in almost subliminally. What I didn't want to do is just suddenly take out 5 pages and say, the Independent Labour Party did this and did that. I had to dramatise it all the time. So it always had to be people doing something and quite dramatise it. But it's very interesting because it's a long while since I wrote this, and it's nice to see it coming out now. But when I started rereading the proofs from my publisher, I began to get really interested in some of the material again. And I found myself going back, and I found myself doing a lot of extra material. Have you ever come across somebody called Tom Maguire in Leeds? Yeah, Tom Maguire's fascinating, isn't he? He's somebody who comes only sort of tangentially into the book. He appears in this first section. He dies between the first section and second section. But his is a fascinating story, and I should say, anybody interested, the Independent Labour Party, which still exists, because I'm wearing their badge here, the Independent Labour Party have a Leeds address, and they have produced E.P. Thompson's brilliant little pamphlet on Tom Maguire. And it's well worth getting a hold of if anybody's interested in local history and interested in those areas. And if you just go online, you can find it. It's really, really, really fascinating material. But the whole thing is great. But yeah, it almost made me feel, you know, like I felt like I almost might want to go, thinking of Tom Maguire, that I might even want to return to it and try and write about it again. But then I've got a bit of a thing about Ramsay MacDonald. Ramsay MacDonald really fascinates me, you know. Strange, strange character. I think there's a book there, you know. Sometime, anyway. Very interesting man.
Just before we close, Bill, and get everyone to go and buy a copy of your book over there, which you will sign. I don't know if you've any thoughts on what the characters, as you inhabited them while you were writing this, what they would think of the Labour Party today.
Oh, it's difficult. Very, very difficult to say. I don't think Grayson would think much of it. I mean, Grayson was always an anarchist, really. I mean, he was always going to just sort of like tear everything up. And I think if he'd ever got himself in a position of eminence, he'd have just torn it all to pieces immediately. Just he'd have the fun of building it and then torn it straight down again. That's just, some people are like that. I don't know. I think both of them would, in a way. I mean, I find it quite easy to be cynical about the Labour Party at the moment. And I've always been, you know, on the left, on the kind of hard left, really. But I think that at the moment, I think they'd be very proud to see it. I think what they'd be very, very glad to see. Well, of course, their big thing was to get rid of the Liberals. And they might be rather bemused to see the Liberals coming back. But they might be rather pleased to see what happens or doesn't happen to the Conservative Party. So I think that might make a bit of a difference. But yeah, I think there is a continuity. And I would say, and I'm not trying to plug my own book, but...
That's what you're here for.
Well, yeah, I am. But not only to do that. There's a piece of writing online which is if you go, for those of you who are online, if you go to a website called the Unheard website, which is UNHERD, it's like a kind of left of center. It's a lot of people in publishing, political writers, sociologists, academics, writers, poets, etc., who just sort of write about current affairs. And a guy called Boyd Tonkin, who used to be literary editor of the Independent newspaper, he wrote a big thing on the current state of the Labour Party with reference to my novel, which he did like. But it's very, very interesting the context that he puts it into. And it's, you know, it would take a very, very long time for me to explore the themes that he really brilliantly explores. Leave aside what he thinks about my novel. It's a fantastic piece of writing. And his whole thing at the end of it is that original Labour Party is still there underneath it all. And when I read him, I suddenly thought, do you know, he may well be right. It's not all lost and gone. Oh, those are the great days. Look at all these kind of, you know, technocrat guys. You know, look at all these wonks and the party managers. I think he's right. I think the heart is still beating there. And he talks about the strangeness of Labour's broad church. And I think that strange broad church is still there. And I don't think we should be despairing and thinking, well, we've got a bad hand here and, you know, everybody's being very, very careful. I have a distinct feeling, but then I'm a born optimist, really. I have a distinct feeling that certainly Fred and Phil Snowden would both feel that this Labour Party could well be surprising us all. And I hope and pray that's true. But no, I feel very positive, and they certainly would, because they never gave up anyway. They always remain believers through the most terrible things, really, but never lost their belief.
Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you. Dear.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.